Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 1. To have your Bibles, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 20. You hear me back there, Russell? Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 1. When thou goest out to battle against thine enemies, and you see horses and chariots and people more than you are. The Jewish army at this time was basically infantry. Whenever an infantry type army faces a mobile army, it gives them a little bit of a shock. Horses refer to cavalry, chariots to the armored forces, and they're outnumbered, people more than thou. Here is the directive from the Lord, be not afraid of them. For the Lord thy God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be when you are come nigh unto the battle, that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people. Now the priest is the comparable to the chaplain. There was the prophet who communicated spoken doctrine. There was the priest who communicated written doctrine. Written and spoken doctrine were the two sources of communication in the Old Testament times. The priest acted as the chaplain. There are certain legitimate areas of temporary relief from military service. These are given as the priest begins his dissertation. He says in verse 3, and he shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day unto battle against your enemies, a bona fide function for believers. Let not your heart faint, cowardice. Fear not, command not to stop fearing. Do not tremble, loss of control over the body, neither be terrified because of them. For your Lord, your God, he it is that goeth with you to save you against your enemies, or to fight for you against your enemies, and to deliver you. Now this is the priestly ministry, and this is his message. And behind this is the principle that warfare demands moral courage. Moral courage is located in the right lobe. This is the perceptive lobe on the left side. Moral courage means that there must be spiritual sustaining for this, and that, of course, is Bible doctrine in the human spirit, called kakma in the Hebrew, epinosis in the Greek. This was a generation of all believers, so this is very pertinent to them. They understand this immediately. Now, once the chaplain has finished his message, which deals with moral courage, there are certain ones who have a lapse of mental attitude, which makes moral courage impossible. Just as we have already seen, mental attitude sins destroy the Norman standard lobe. So there are certain functions in life which are legitimate functions in themselves, but which eliminate people from being effective and fulfilling what has been required, to be not afraid. So we read in verse 5, and the officers, these are company commanders, battalion commanders, shall speak unto the soldier, saying, What man is there that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Dedication means not only living in it, but living in it with a family. Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in battle, and another man dedicate it. In other words, this person is so distracted that he has neither moral courage nor concentration necessary for a combat situation. This means he'll get himself killed. Any type of emotional or mental distraction is one of the easiest ways to get killed. I knew a combat flyer who had a great record. In fact, he was an ace. And when he came back to the States after a tour of duty, which he had been a great war hero, He found that his wife had deserted him, gone off with someone else, and this upset him so badly that he asked for combat duty again. He went back and got himself killed. He couldn't concentrate anymore. He was distracted. And this is more or less the concept here. There's a concentration and a dedication necessary for combat to stay alive. And the ones who stay alive are the ones who concentrate. You know, often students in school are smart enough to get better grades, but they don't know how to concentrate and they have no self-discipline. And the same lack of self-discipline and lack of concentration gets them killed in battle when they shouldn't be. And it is true that the heaviest casualties in any battle you want to take in history come from, one, cowards. Cowards, of course, run away, turn their back to the enemy, freeze in the spot where the enemy can zero in on them. And those who are distracted. And one reason men have always fought wars. Since the beginning of time, wars have been fought by men because man has the ability to concentrate and focus his attention on serving as a part of a military team and killing off the enemy. The emotional involvement, a woman is so emotionally involved that she cannot do this. A woman has to be work herself up to a high pitch of emotion and hatred to kill. And of course, it doesn't last. And then she goes through all of the regression, regret concepts. Now, the reason is because a woman has a supercharger, an emotional supercharger. By the way, I thought I was going to get by tonight. Young people in Texas have good manners. Now, I'm ready to go back and take a boy and jerk him up by the ears. If you want to talk, son, come on up here. You understand me? If you don't, I'll come back there and move you out. Because one thing you're going to learn in this class, if you don't learn anything else, and that's good manners. And you talk to that young lady again, I'm going to personally throw you out. You read me loud and clear. I brag too often on Texans and their good manners to let that go by. Now, one reason why women can never serve in combat is because they are responders, because they have a supercharger in the emotion of the soul, and because concentration, which is necessary for this type of thing, simply does not come their way. It is historically traditional that when the men who are of the fighting age become effeminate, or when they get a maximum number of homosexuals, or when they begin to act like women and become responders, or become children, babies, when men do this, then that nation's armies are wiped out. Because they are not amenable to military training. And because they are not amenable to military training and discipline, which is necessary to function as a combat team, they get slaughtered. And that's one reason why, for example, hippies would never make good soldiers. Hippies wear long hair, like women. And any time that a man transfers his character to that of a woman, he's a responder, standing around waiting to be introduced, as it were. Well, obviously, then, he's in trouble. I remember during World War II, they used to try to describe the characteristics of various races. And they had a ship full of all of these races, and they were the ship went down, and these people all made it ashore in lifeboats. And when they got on this island, for example, the Germans began to drill the natives, organize an army immediately. And the Scots began to set up a bank, and the French began to organize a wine growers business, and the Australians started building a racetrack, and the Americans opened an automobile agency, and the English were standing around waiting to be introduced. Now, the principle is being a responder. And when a man loses the concentration and the aggressiveness of manhood, and when he becomes effeminate And when he becomes emotional and subjective about these things, then he's going to get killed in combat. And three times we have in this passage, lest he die, lest he die, lest he die in battle. Now a second one is a man starting out in business. Verse 6, and what man is he that hath planted a vineyard and hath not yet eaten of it? Let him also go and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man eat of it. This is an agricultural economy, and his business is a vineyard. To eat of it means to profit from it. He hasn't even had his first year's profit from it. And so he is concentrating on his business. He is a double-minded man. He is in his perceptive lobe. Here's his perceptive lobe. He's thinking about his business. And therefore, that cancels out his concentration on his norm and standard lobe, and this is the source of his moral courage. So not only do mental attitude sins eliminate the function of your norm and standard lobe, but the new house and the business also do the same thing. They destroy moral courage and one gets killed. The third is a young man who is engaged but isn't married. What man is he? And what man is there that hath betrothed a wife and hath not taken her? The word to take is the Hebrew word lakak, and it means to consummate the marriage with sex. Let him go and return to his house. Why? Lest he die in battle and another man take her. In other words, once again, you have a double-minded man, unstable in all of his ways. Over here, he is thinking about this girl to whom he is engaged. So he's thinking about what is to him a femme fatale. And on this side, this neutralizes his battle concentration, for moral courage is the basis for battle courage, and it comes from this lobe. And he is divided in his concentration, and therefore he's had it. So these are legitimate reasons to remove people from fighting. Double-minded, unstable. They are not mentally fit for combat. Now there is another category, verse 8. The officer shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? This is a coward. He's afraid. He's fearful and he's faint-hearted. Now, a coward will obviously get himself killed. But a coward is wiped out here, and he gets others killed. A coward panics. A coward doesn't have poise. A coward doesn't realize certain battle principles. You know, there are certain principles in life in almost any field that are absolutely the opposite of your instincts. For example, when you learn to drive an automobile and you get into a jam, the instinctive thing is to hit the brakes, to slow down the juggernaut. To slow down is the worst thing. For example, if you're flying, it's just the opposite. A gal once wrote to her boyfriend, who was a flying cadet, and she said to him, well, don't forget to fly low and slow. Well, these are two of the most dangerous things that could ever happen to you, is low and slow. But instinctively, you see, that's what you want to do. But you see, when you learn to fly, you have to break through these instincts, and you have to get all the altitude you can and all the speed you can to establish a glide. So it's just the opposite. It's opposite your instincts, whatever your instinct happens to be. Now, the same thing is true in combat. Instinctively, you want to get away from the enemy. Instinctively, you want to stay where you are, and these are the two basic reasons why men get killed on the ground in combat. And contrary to all instincts, the quicker you get to the enemy and move toward him, the safer you are. The last 50 yards before you hit the enemy, those are the safest. The last 100 yards are safe. But anything out to 1,000 yards, you've had it. See, the enemy is cool, calm, and collected. He's zeroed in on you. If you sit still in one spot, he will be able to zero in on you sooner. He knows where you are. It's just a matter of time. He can have some observer sitting over here on a hill and calling the shots, and they'll kill you if you stay there. If you run, then you're an easier target yet. There's only one direction to go, and that's toward the enemy. But all human instincts and cowardice say go in the opposite direction. So it takes moral courage in that right lobe to move toward the enemy, which is the right thing to do. It takes a lot of training to get people used to this idea. This is one of the big things of military training, to give that instinct of moving toward the enemy instead of away from the enemy. Now, a coward always blows it. If you have a good organization, you have one coward, and the one coward gets up and runs the other way or freezes, everyone will freeze, or they'll start, others will start running. It's amazing how catching cowardice is. It takes twice as much for one person with courage to hold things in place and to move toward the enemy than it does for one coward. One coward can wreck years of military training, and you will notice this passage, this is the Word of God, and this is a principle of doctrine. One coward and everyone gets killed. Now this is a coward hits everyone else. So he says, let him go and return to his house in the middle of verse 8, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. In other words, once that happens, they've all had it. Now it's once they finish this part, weeding out the cowards and weeding out those who have a legitimate reason because of being double-minded, then the next job is combat. Now what is the responsibility of combat? Verse 13. And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thine hands, the land, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. Victory must be followed up by annihilation of the enemy. The greatest illustration of this was the Battle of Cannae. For 17 years, Hannibal was able to stay in Italy because of that one battle. Now, Hannibal had a makeshift army. Hannibal was one of the great generals of all time. And he took his sorriest troops and he put them in his center. And he took his Carthaginian and Numidian infantry and he put them out here in the sides. He advanced them out here. And the Romans thought that this looked pretty weak to them. So the Romans, without thinking, under the council for the day, Paulus, charged and they hit. And as they hit, they just broke right through, and they were just doing fine. And then this great infantry, body of infantry on each side, turned and hit them. And in less than 5 hours, 50,000 Romans died, the cream of the crop of that generation. 50,000 Romans, and that was just with swords and spears, bows and arrows. And that's a lot of people to die in 5 hours. But the reason was because of the tactics involved here. And once they were crushed in here, the Romans were crushed in so tight they were just like, it was like a slaughter pen. They were all just crushed in here tight, and they just closed in on them and they hit them from all sides. It was one of the most decisive battles in history. But the main thing was that the Carthaginian army kept slaughtering and slaughtering, and when they had finished, the Romans were minus 50,000, the cream of the crop, and Hannibal had his way in Italy for 17 years. In fact, this almost destroyed Rome at this time because their agricultural economy was destroyed by the invasion and by the invader. Now, you see, the principle here is a very simple one. Once you have the enemy on the run, you kill him. Now, this is contrary to the thinking of liberalism. And because it is contrary to the thinking of liberalism, it's time that doctrine came into the forefront of our thinking again. You have to slaughter the enemy. When you have him on the run, hit him hard. This is the principle. Don't let up. Don't feel sorry for him. Same principle in football. When you have a team on the run, you hit them hard. Once you start feeling sorry for them, you can even get overtaken. I remember one time being 5 touchdowns ahead of another team and starting to relax and going to have a big time and horse around. And next thing you know, they came right up to even with us. And if we finally settled down in the last quarter and won the ball game after they came out ahead of us. And then we won by a touchdown. That was it. But it was so close and it was such a squeaker. See, everyone lets up. You can't ever let up. One thing you cannot afford to have in combat or in football, and that's sympathy. You cannot do that. You have to be tough. You have to stay in there, and in combat you have to slaughter the enemy. This is a failure that's going to overtake us. If you don't kill them, they will kill you at a later time. They never forget, and they'll kill you. So you will notice that for the Jews to have peace in the land, thou shalt smite every male with the edge of the sword. Verse 17, thou shalt utterly destroy them. Annihilation is the principle of warfare. It is a biblical principle. All right, I'm going to develop that in more detail on our 4th of July conference. But basically now, point 7, war demands a mental attitude of both moral and battle courage. And this is the passage that eliminates the cowards. In Psalm 27:3, we have point 8. Point 8, the importance of doctrine in warfare. Psalm 27:3, warfare has so many shocks connected with it. The shock of killing people, the shock of having an imagination and thinking about them as being young people in some other country and having sweethearts or wives or mothers and so on. All of these things occur to people. So it's important to keep doctrine as your viewpoint for combat. So point 8 is the importance of doctrine in combat. Psalm 27:3. What should be the general concept in combat? What should be your attitude? What is the mental attitude of the believer under a combat situation? Psalm 27:3. Though an host should encamp against me. This is a large army. This is David speaking. David was a great warrior, a great soldier. My heart shall not fear. The heart is the right lobe, the moral courage lobe. Here is the Norman standard lobe, and this is where we have frame of reference. With frame of reference, we are minus fear. My heart shall not fear. That's verse 3. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. That's a kel active participle of batak, which looks like this. B-A-T-A-C-H. Batak, two wrestlers. One wrestler body slams another. Batak means to trust God in the sense of putting the problem in His hands. And the principle and the attitude for combat here is a very simple one. God has a plan for your life. That plan was designed in eternity past. That plan is going to continue as long as God's plan for your life continues. There never will be a time when anyone in this world, the enemy, no one can take you out of the world apart from God's will and God's permission. Therefore, as long as God has a plan for your life, you are just as safe in combat as you are at a Sunday school picnic. You are perfectly, totally, completely safe. You cannot be removed. And therefore, in combat, your objective before the Lord is to kill the enemy, to be without fear. Now, everyone has some sort of fear. Bobby wrote a letter the other day, and he said, well, here I am with the 10th generation of people in this country who have faced war. He said, war is a terrible thing. He said, Everyone recognizes that it's a bloody, awful, horrible thing, but he says the last 10 generations of Americans have faced the problem of fear. They have been able to overcome this problem. They have been able to go into battle. They have been able to fight and to win the freedoms for which they were fighting. And he said, now we have a generation. He said, all these guys around here are afraid. They're afraid to go to combat. They're afraid to go to Vietnam. He said, they're afraid of everything. They're afraid of killing the enemy in hand-to-hand combat. And he said, yet that's a part of their training here. You see, this concept of fear, everyone has fear, but it's the ability to overcome it. And the greatest overcomer of fear is Bible doctrine. This gives moral courage. All right, Psalm 27:3. Though an host should encamp against me, the right lobe, the Norman standard lobe, shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in spite of this, literally, the Hebrew says, in spite of this, I keep on trusting. Faith rest technique. Now invert the ninth point, the importance of doctrine in military leadership. We turn now to Proverbs chapter 24, verse 1. Proverbs 24, 1. The importance of Bible doctrine and military leadership. Proverbs chapter 24, verse 1. Now, by way of getting in, what do we mean by military leadership? Well, first of all, military leadership has its first characteristic, self-discipline. No one can ever be a military leader without self-discipline. Perfect illustration of this is Robert E. Lee after the Battle of Gettysburg. When that great catastrophe hit the Army of Northern Virginia, he was perfectly calm. Everyone was hysterical and upset. He went from one group of troops to another. He says, it's all my fault. Move back to the rear. Move to this road. Move to that wagon. Move to this bivouac. He was very calm. He kept his cool. And he actually was able to pull together the remnants of the Army of Northern Virginia after that famous charge called Pickett's Charge, although it was Longstreet's Corps involved. And he was able to pull everything together. He had tremendous self-discipline. Never blamed anyone else, never reproached anyone else, pulled the whole army together and was able to get them back across the river even and to preserve them. So self-discipline is absolutely necessary. You must also have a concept of group discipline. This is probably one of the things most lacking in our country today is the concept of group discipline. There are only a few ways that people learn about group discipline. One, of course, is to play on some kind of a team. And to realize that the objective of the team and that the teamwork is more important than being an individual star and so on. Another is to live with a group of people where in a barracks or in some kind of a school organization where you realize the importance of group discipline as it relates to self-discipline. Very few people have actually had the opportunity of practicing group discipline anymore because they've never been a member, for example, of a combat team. Never been a bombardier, a navigator, or a first or second pilot, or a gunner, or a radio operator in some kind of a team where every member of the team depends on every other member of the team for his life. Or to be in, for example, a rifle platoon where they have at least two different kinds of weapons and sometimes three. And they have one man who has an anti-tank weapon. And that one man with that recoilless rifle, when the tanks start coming, the only protection that platoon has is from this one man, so they have to depend on him. And until people have to depend for their lives or for victory or for something on others, they lose track of this team discipline concept. It's every man for himself. So leadership must recognize both the importance of self-discipline and group discipline. A second characteristic of military leadership is the principle of character, not personality. Personality does not enter into it at all, except when some person like Franklin Roosevelt's promoting people to general officer. But it isn't a matter of personality, it's a matter of character. And there are probably five characteristics necessary for any great leader. Loyalty. A leader must be loyal to his men. Just as we saw Sunday morning, a boss must be loyal to his employees. See, loyalty is a two-way street. I've seen people, for example, who demanded loyalty of others, but they never gave them any. Never went to bat for them. Zeal. There must be an understanding. Zeal is orientation, understanding of what you're doing. This is all a part of character. Zeal is orientation to what you're doing and doing it, well, for the believer, it's doing it as unto the Lord. For the unbeliever, it's doing it for the sake of freedom, for the sake of others, for the sake of loved ones. Thoroughness. We won't go into that one. Initiative is more important. Initiative and force. A good military leader must have both initiative and force. He must be aggressive because, you see, all great military successes are based not upon defense, but they're based upon offensive. You have to take the offensive. And to keep troops like we're doing in Vietnam. Here they are in South Vietnam, and they're sitting there. They're sitting here, and they're sitting here, and they're sitting here, and they're sitting here. And so the enemy has, years to decide how he's going to attack you and how he's going to get you. And he may take 18 months for a reconnaissance. But when he hits you, he's pretty sure he's going to get you. You cannot sit still. That's what the French did. The whole concept of the French in May of 1940 was to sit still. In fact, they had had it for about 20 years. From 1920 to 1940, the French put billions of dollars into the Maginot Line, which was considered one of the greatest defense systems in the world. Here's Switzerland. And here is the North Sea. And here is the Ardennes Forest. And this is such a great forest, they didn't need to put anything there. So the Germans made a reconnaissance starting about 1934. German officers began to take vacations, and they'd go, they all liked to visit this forest over here, so beautiful, the Ardennes Forest. And they enjoyed vacationing here, and all the time they were spying out the topography. So there was a very famous, the father of German army, Guderian, General Guderian. And so he set up an armored force. The first, it was an armored division plus. We'll make it a corps, an armored corps. He set up an armored corps, and they went right through the Ardennes Forest. It took them about 4 days. And then right behind them was motorized infantry, and they fanned out here, and they fanned out here. And the French were accustomed to sitting there. The idea of getting up and moving, there was only one person that advocated moving and teaching troops to move and to have any armored force, and his name was de Gaulle. And he managed to move a few troops here and a few troops here, but that was just a paper tiger, and they broke through every time. And it took less than 3 months to conquer all of France. Reason? They thought in terms of defense, and once you start to think in terms of defense, you've had it. It's the offensive team that wins. It's the offensive team that scores. It's the team that has the ball that scores. So you need initiative. This is why Lee wouldn't sit tight in Virginia, like, of course, Jeff Davis wanted him to do. He wanted to get up and move, get up and move, and he had the right idea. He just didn't have the horses with him. Now, the third thing that everyone must have who is going to be great in leadership, and especially military leadership, is common sense. You can never be a theorist and have no common sense and make it. We have a great illustration in our history. Nathan Bedford Forrest, who knew a lot about shooting, but had never been in a military situation until the war between the states started, and he started out as a private and wound up as a lieutenant general. And he was one of the best, at the end of the war, he was the greatest cavalry commander on either side. Trouble is, he just didn't have any horses. Understanding of people is very important. Executive ability, which means both administrative ability, the systematic development of things, being able to think categorically. One of the greatest people of all time in the ability to think categorically, and I'll just put him down, you look him up. He had more of an effect upon modern history than almost anyone else. Von Moltke. I bet you've never heard of him. I know you haven't. And yet, most of you knew someone in World War II, and he had a lot to do with it. He's the basic cause, because he could categorize so well. He was a very famous German general, Prussian, North Germany. Because he could think categorically, militarily, better than anyone else that ever lived in his day, he actually is the basis for three wars: the Franco-Prussian War, World War I, and World War II. You've never heard of him? And yet three wars, great wars, have been fought because he had the ability to think categorically. Frederick the Great had that ability. Napoleon had that ability. Also, you must have intelligence. Be able to grasp new ideas, alertness, concentration, analysis, synthesis. And also, this has something to do with nationality. There are certain types of people who have military perspicacity. There are some nationalities that never have it. The greatest nationalities for military perspicacity are, one, the Assyrians, who disappeared from history, the Romans, people like Caesar, Gaius Julius Caesar, the Prussians of North Germany, like Frederick the Great, and no one knows exactly his racial origin, but we'll call him a Carthaginian, Hannibal. Some nationalities do not have the ability to maneuver large armies. These include the blacks, who have never had a general who could maneuver, for example, 500,000 men and do it successfully. It's very difficult for us to think here tonight just what it requires to be a great general. But let's take three German armies These three armies number about 2 million men. This army was in command of a man by the name of von Lieb. This army was commanded by von Rundstedt. This army was commanded by von Bach. Each one of this line represents 1,000 miles. These armies were scattered over 1,000 miles on the border of Russia. And when Hitler gave the command to invade Russia, these three armies started to move. They moved for 500 miles. Von Lieb went up north and finally hit Petrograd. Von Rundstedt, the Battle of Bialystok Minsk, the Battle of Vyazma Bryansk, he was able to penetrate 500 miles and destroy 3 million Russians. Not enough, but it was a start. Von Bach went down here to Kiev, and he destroyed 1.5 million Russians. They were outnumbered. They only had 500,000 between each one of these armies, had roughly 500,000. At Vyazma Bryansk, we have a tactical double envelopment and a tactical penetration, and Moscow is open. Here's Moscow. But von Bach says, this is the secret of Russia. This is the great wheat belt. He said, I have moved behind Kiev and around it. Come on down and join me here. Von Rundstedt put a holding force here and moved his whole army down here. He moved over 500,000 people over 500 miles, and he did it in a week. And they closed the pincers here, and they captured Kiev. And by the time he got back up here, the winter hit, and they didn't get into Moscow. But they had done something even greater. They had actually destroyed, in 2.5 months, over 3 million Russians and captured another 1.5 million. They had eliminated nearly 5 million Russian soldiers. Now, these men were men of genius. You don't think they were men of genius? You take 25 teenagers and try to get them to go from Houston to Hempstead in 5 different cars and all arrive at precisely the same time as you have designated, having figured out all the logistics and so on. See what happens. Well, you see, these men dealt with millions of people. These men were men of great genius. Well, you have to have something else. You have to have health. You have to have endurance. You have to have nervous stability. You have to have presence. You have to have the dress, the carriage, the ability to think and use language, and everything necessary in order to function. And we're talking about military leadership. So you have to have military leadership to be successful in battle. Now, basically, what is the source of military leadership? I have avoided mentioning doctrine. I have simply given some of the characteristics. All right, let's see what the basis is. Be not thou envious against evil men, neither desire to be with them. Now, the first characteristic is you cannot have mental attitude sins. This is your Norman standard lobe. Mental attitude sins will wipe you out. Neither desire to be with them. Their heart studieth destruction, and their lips talk mischief. They produce misery. Now, how are you going to be successful? Through wisdom is a house built. Now, wisdom is Bible doctrine coming into the perception lobe, filling of the Spirit, transferred down to the human spirit, cycled up here as divine viewpoint, exhaled toward God, exhaled toward man, and the erection of the edification complex. That's wisdom. And wisdom is the basis of building the life. By wisdom is the house built, and wisdom is Bible doctrine in the human spirit. By understanding, one prepares himself. Once you have doctrine here and cycle it up here, you are preparing yourself. Here's doctrine in the human spirit, brought down by faith. Now it is cycled up into the Norman standard lobe. Once you cycle doctrine up into the Norman standard lobe, then you are preparing yourself. By understanding, that's understanding doctrine, one prepares himself. And by knowledge, this is knowledge of doctrine, the chambers are filled. These are the chambers of the soul, are filled with precious and pleasant riches. Now, verse 5, a wise man, this is a military leader, by the way, is strong. Yes, a man of knowledge of doctrine, increases his ability, the ability in the military profession. How do we know this? Verse 6, for by wise counsel, Or literally, a capable general shall make war. Not by a wise counsel, but by a capable general thou shalt make war. The next phrase, in a multitude of counselors there is safety, is not found here at all. The last phrase of verse 6 says, victory is in the greatness of the one counseling, of the one giving the commands. Victory is in the greatness of the one giving commands. In other words, the military leader. And the military leader here, going back to verse 3 for a moment, he must have wisdom and understanding, and in verse 4 he must have knowledge. Now this is all referring to Bible doctrine. So point 9, here is the importance of doctrine as far as military leadership is concerned. And the fact that you need professional military leadership is taught in Proverbs chapter 20, verse 18. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 18. Every purpose is established. This is planning for war. Every purpose is established by counsel. This counsel comes from doctrine, military leadership, born again type. And with good advice, make war. Making war is a matter of careful planning. It's a matter of good judgment. It's a matter of good advice. So Proverbs chapter 20, 18 says, it is necessary to have professional military leadership. Of course, you realize in our country, our policy has been to destroy our military leadership. Our policy has been to so subject them to the civilians that they have no control over a battlefield, they have no control anywhere, and systematically, but in reality, our military leadership has been discouraged, our military leadership has been neutralized. And we do not have today good military leadership. It has been destroyed. It has been stifled. It has been ruined by civilian interference. In other words, it's one of the ways to destroy our country. All right, we're going to begin next time with point 10. God prepares a believer for military training. We'll start at that point next time, point 10. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying Thy Word. May God the Holy Spirit challenge us by these things, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.